Welcome to In the Studios, Medium Rare. I'm Redbeard, and today it's a conversation with a Beatles firstborn son, Julian Lennon.
Guitar up. One, two, three.
In four decades of conversations with the world's foremost popular music performers and writers, I've never read anything quite like this public relations person's unblinking assessment of the unique challenges placed in front of John Lennon's first child, Julian, when the Beatles' eldest embarked on a music career. Quote, "As a son of one of the most influential and creative voices of the modern era, Julian Lennon knew that his work would come under particularly tough scrutiny, consciously or subconsciously held against an exceptional standard. On all counts, it was an unenviable position," end quote. Wow, and that's coming from someone paid to be in your corner. Sheesh. Practically anyone then could understand why Julian Lennon would be a photographer, an animated voiceover actor, an environmental activist, or a charitable spokesman, all of which he's doing today. Nonetheless, in 1984, at the tender age of just 21, Julian released his debut album, Velotte, named after the French chateau where it was recorded. In front of a live audience, I asked Julian, named after his paternal grandmother Julia, and famously name-checked in the Beatles song Hey Jude, I asked him how it all started in his famous father's footsteps.
I reached the point where I thought I had some decent material, and what I did was I initially approached an acquaintance who owned a studio, and I sort of begged them that if I could do a couple of serious demos, that as soon as I got a record deal from that, I'd be able to pay them back. Only I didn't get a record deal, and I got caught in a very weird situation where the owner of the studio told me that he'd already lined up a record deal for me with some weird unknown company in France, which unless I paid up, I'd have to sign up with, literally, otherwise there'd be in legal battles, you know. And there was another acquaintance that sort of, who was a friend also, that sort of had seen what was going on and offered to step in. And so he did. He paid off the demo bills, began while I started to continue writing. He went around and literally shopped the tapes to every door of every company, you know, either sending them through the post or actually going to visit them themselves for over a year, you know. And nobody wanted to touch me with a barge pole, purely because of the association, you know. And finally, a couple of the songs were playing at one of the record companies, and the boss of the record company, who's called Tony Stratton Smith, who's unfortunately no longer with us, walked into the room as the stuff, the tracks were playing, and said, "Who is this?" And everybody said, "Well, we don't know. We just got a couple of tapes we're going through." And he said, "Well, let's find out. I want to sign him." And that was that. And that was my break. This guy loved the songs, and the only one out there willing to give me a chance, which I appreciate. You know.
The song that probably introduced your work, your talent to America, came from your debut, Velotte. Let's take a listen to Too Late to Say Goodbye.
Thank you.
I've always loved the ska reggae shuffle of Julian Lennon's Too Late for Goodbye from his 1984 debut Valotte. The song charted exceedingly high for a first attempt at number 5 on Billboard's singles chart. But did he really realize what the media scrutiny would be after that first blush of success?
Well, initially when I first had the record deal, I really didn't know what I was in for. I really didn't. And I mean, my idea for it all was that, you know, for me there was no shadow, there was no comparisons, there was no this or that. It was just me writing my own stuff and releasing it. And it went fine until, you know, sort of like halfway through the album when we started getting, you know, the criticism and the comparisons. The comparisons being fine, but the majority of criticism wasn't constructive. You know, it wasn't to the point. It wasn't really dealing with what I was trying to say or what I was trying to do. And it became very tough. And I tended to listen to a lot of people a lot, you know, purely because I was new in the business and this was my first sort of first-hand experience with it. You know, obviously I'd seen bits and bobs from the sidelines and, you know, everybody says, well, everybody finds a trouble spot in their career. You know, nobody goes through it with a breeze. And I really didn't know what to expect until finally, with the pressure of having to go into the second album from the people I was working with, when it really wasn't time. I mean, they wanted me to go in on the back of the first one's success and literally said, well, listen, you have 2 months to do the album. I said, you got to be crazy. It takes time to be creative. I take what I do very seriously. It's an art form to me. It's a craft. You know, it takes time to nurture songs, to make them grow so that not only you understand and have a clear representation of what's being said, but the audience can relate to it too in a very clear way and hopefully get your point. And unfortunately, I really got lost in that second album because all those people that I'd relied upon to be there to support me had just sort of backed off and sort of thrown me in the deep end. And I got very confused on who to believe in after that.
Sitting on the doorstep of the house again to fall on, I can feel you there. Thinking of a reason, well, it's really not very hard to love you. The meaning of our love, it fits so tight.
The title song to Julian Lennon's 1984 debut, Velotte, cracked the top 10, driving album sales to number 17 in the U.S., number 20 in the U.K., and an obvious nomination for Best New Artist at the 85 Grammy Awards. But without given enough time to amass sufficient strong songs for the follow-up called The Secret Value of Daydreaming in 86, the critics pounced and panned the effort. By 1989's third release, entitled Mr. Jordan, the critics added indifference to their disdain. So it's no wonder that Julian Lennon slid into a self-medicated depression from which he barely survived. No wonder he was ostracized by his father, John, until Julian was 10. Then they got close in the mid-70s, only to be cut out of his father's will.
Got lost for a couple of years, basically, in trying to decide what was best or how I should go about what I was going to do.
Excuse me for interjecting, but that was a very dark time. You say it now with a facetious laugh off simply because it was very scary for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was very scary.
I mean, we almost lost you.
It got to the point where I'd sort of abused myself mentally and physically, where I just had enough, basically, you know, and until I finally sort of looked in the mirror and said, what the hell am I doing to myself? How can these people be affecting my mind and changing my mind in such a way that I have no control over not only my career, but myself anymore? And that's when I finally, you know, had to make a serious change. And for me, the third album was sort of just getting back on my feet.
What makes me happy? You think you know what makes me cry? You think you know everything about me? Well, from the horse's mouth it slides. You say you know the situation. Say you understand just why. You know shit about absolutely nothing. You're gonna get no clues from the sky. You should think about not faking all the time. Discretion is a word that's always on my mind. Don't make down, you're such a clown. Just take that red nose off your face. Don't you feel ashamed? Don't you feel disgraced? You're afraid to admit to being guilty. You're afraid to stare at your face. And you pretend that life is always rosy. Wake up and join the human race. How can you honestly say you love me when you can't even love yourself? You think your word is gospel now. You're just repeating past opinions. Not faking all the time. Discretion is a word that's always on my mind. Don't make me listen. I just can't listen. Cause it brings me down. You're such a clown. Just take that red nose off your face. Don't you feel ashamed? Don't you feel disgraced? You should think about
you come. Just take that red nose off your face. Don't you feel ashamed? Don't you feel disgraced? Don't you feel disgraced? Ooh. Don't you feel disgraced?
Digging on those terrific sounding slide guitar chords on the song Listen, which appeared on Julian Lennon's strong 1991 album Help Yourself, almost criminally ignored in the U.S.
Julian, I sat down and I noticed the producers that you have attracted is like a who's who of the greatest producers that are out there. For instance, who produced your debut album, Velocity?
Well, that was done by Phil Ramone, who's had many a hit and a great career with people like Billy Joel, etc., you know, and so many old greats from the past as well. We worked on the second album together, only unfortunately, as far as I'm concerned, we didn't have enough time to do anything, you know. The third album, I worked with Pat Leonard, who's known for his work with Madonna and Brian Ferry, and many, many others too, you know. So I've been very fortunate to work with quite a variety. And with this one, Bob Ezrin, who has worked with Pink Floyd in the past, Peter Gabriel, Lou Reed, and many others too.
You've had the opportunity to work with really three of the best out there. What do you think attracts them to your work?
Well, I mean, hopefully it's the stuff I write, you know, the songs I write. Because I think very much that they're generally from an old school of thought as far as producing is concerned, where the songs are the most important things. And a lot of music today, in my opinion anyway, doesn't hold a foundation as a song. It's mainly sounds and rhythm, which is okay to a degree, but then a lot of those serious musicians that write their stuff, sing their stuff, play their stuff themselves, tend to get blown out the window, you know. So I think mainly that's the reason behind it, is that they are from that school of the song is the most important thing. And hopefully what I do is as sincere and honest as one can get in writing songs. This album is definitely, you know, working with Bob Ezrin was so great, because he taught me basically not to deny myself of who I am anymore. You know, he said, listen, Jules, as long as you're honest with yourself, as long as you're true with yourself, as long as you believe in your work 100%, there's nothing to be afraid of, you know. And that's when I started, and also I was very miserable about the fact that I wasn't allowing myself the influences in my life, the Beatle influences, which I'd cut out after the second album. I wasn't allowing that back into my life. And that was such a big part of me, you know, of my writing. And so finally with this album, I said, right, sod it, you know, this is it. I'll do what feels comfortable, what feels natural, and I'll believe in it. And again, being honest and true with myself, if people love what I do, then I love them for it. Thank you, that's great. If they don't, it's okay. I don't mind, but I'm not going to be bothered by it anymore, you know, or feel pressured by it.
There's a light on that covers the blue, and I want to be closer to you. And she's smiling and waving goodbye. Who'd have thought that I'd ever ask why? And she's waving goodbye that photograph smile under the heavenly blue.
her again. I'll never know. I'll never feel you ever again. And I wait sitting here by the phone, with the hope that your heart is in stone. And I wish that you'd call me and cry, so I'd know how you feel deep inside. And she's waving goodbye with that photograph smile again. I'll never know. I'll never feel you ever again. Heavenly voice, won't you guide me? Help me, I'm falling too
exhibiting some real depth of emotional and musical range. That's Julian Lennon with the sublime title song and exquisite arrangement on 1998's Photograph Smile.
Would you have been a singer and a songwriter if your dad was still alive at this point in your life?
Oh yeah, without doubt. Yeah, I mean, I mean, I probably, you know, I would have felt that, in a sense, Dad wouldn't have helped me much. He'd have made me push myself to do it myself, you know, do it on my own, because he likes people that stand and fight for what they believe in and want to do. Maybe I might have gone to him once or twice for a bit of advice, but generally that would have been it, and I would have just hoped that he would have been proud of what I've been doing, you know. You know, the only thing is, as far as some of the criticism and comparisons, I would have felt possibly the only difference would have been that he'd have been around to answer some of those and maybe stick up for me once in a while, and, you know.
Now, I think we ought to tell folks right off the top of the bat that you're a little under the weather today.
Just a little bit, yeah.
old Doc Dentist has been in there working on the old teeth, huh?
Yeah, I have a slight infection all the way down this side of my mouth. So.
Oh, it's awful to be sick. It's awful to have any kind of dental problems, because your whole side of your face hurts, I'll bet.
Well, it's a problem when you're constantly moving, when you're basically in a different city every day, you know, doing God knows how many radio stations and interviews, and there's really not that much time to just sit back and relax. So when something like this comes up, you know, it just doubles the sort of pressure. But it's okay, I'm hanging in there.
Well, at least he says that with a smile, and we appreciate Julian Lennon taking the time to come out and see us.
Well, basically, the idea is just to get around and play a little bit and say hello to everybody and let everybody know that I'm still around and I'm still alive, you know, and to, you know, take the guitars with us. Instead of just doing an interview and sitting down and being relatively boring, we thought it might be an idea to take the acoustics around and to show some people out there that don't think a lot of musicians are credible, that we actually do, we do sing and we do play, and that's what we're here for.
We are a rock revolving around a golden sun. We are a billion children rolled into one. So when I hear about a hole in the sky, salt water wells in my eyes. We climb the highest mountain, we'll make the desert bloom. We're so ingenious we can walk on the moon. But when I hear of how the forests have died, salt water wells in my eyes. I have lived for love, but now that's not enough. For the world I love is dying, and now I'm crying. And time is not a friend,
no friend.
As friends we're out of time, before our eyes. We light the deepest oceans, send photographs of Mars. We're so enchanted by how clever we are. Why should one baby feel so hungry she cries? Salt water wells in my eyes. I have lived for love, but now that's not enough. For the world I love is dying, and now I'm crying. And time is not a friend,
no friend.
As friends we're out of time, and it's slowly passing by. Right before our eyes. We are a rock revolving around a golden sun. We are a billion children rolled into one. What will I think of me the day that I die? Salt water wells in my eyes. Salt water wells in my eyes.
One of the most important contributions to the green environmental musical canon, and originally on 1991's Help Yourself album, that's Julian Lennon, live in Dallas on Thanksgiving Eve, 1991, an in-the-studio exclusive. This is Redbeard in the Studio, thanking my guest, Julian Lennon. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2012, all rights reserved. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook. And for this and many more interviews and live performances by the biggest names in rock, be sure to visit inthestudio.net.